I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For such tiny creatures, it's hard to imagine that a monarch butterfly's migration is more than 10,000 miles long. And this year, Sarah Dykeman is pedaling along beside them from Mexico to Montreal and back. Today, we'll visit with a Kansas City bicyclist who is passing through town again, going south this time. We'll also find out how local efforts are aiding the monarch's voyage and recovery. Then we'll learn why some veterans of the U.S. Armed Forces are being deported, and we'll take a hard look at what it means for the families and communities they leave behind. After that, a sports and protest briefing with reporter Greg Eklund. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Sarah Dykeman is a Johnson County native who was concerned enough about the plight of the monarch butterfly that she decided to hop on her bike and follow them. Monarchs journey each year from Mexico to Montreal and back, generation after generation, year after year. There aren't as many as there used to be, and that's why they're in trouble. Sarah Dykeman is back to tell us about us this morning. And Sarah, so good to see you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dusty Walker, Director of Natural Resources Management at the University of Missouri. Last year, the university launched a program to plant way stations, think of them as rest stops, for the butterflies along their migration route. And Dusty, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Sir, remind us where you traveled since the last time we spoke in May.
Well, I've gone about 5,200 miles since my last stop in Kansas City.
Yeah.
I went up all the way up to Ontario, crossed Ontario into back into the U.S., swam in the Atlantic Ocean, went down to New York City, survived New York City, went back to Ontario, and I've been making my way south, and my last stop was near Columbia, and I took the Katy Trail in.
Wow. As you pedaled along, what did you learn about the monarch butterfly?
I'm learning so much about the monarchs. I'm learning about their habitat. I'm learning about the people taking care of them. Hmm. There's this incredible network of people all along the way planting these way stations, as you call them. I like to call them grocery stores for the monarchs. And they might not see the big picture, but I see the big picture because I'm going and I'm seeing all these different stops, and I'm seeing that I see these caterpillars in these gardens, and if it wasn't for these gardens, these caterpillars wouldn't be here. So the network is really what's keeping me going and inspiring me. And
so help is coming. Is it enough help?
We won't ever have too much help. So we want to just keep building the momentum. We want to keep growing our gardens. I pass plenty of spaces that would still make excellent gardens. Basically, any green grass lawn, any roadside ditch, any space that right now we're just spending a lot of time mowing and fertilizing and watering would make a great garden. So we won't run out of places to plant and help.
Well, Dusty, what got the university's 13 agricultural research centers across the state to plant monarch way stations? I mean, can you give us an idea of how many you were able to establish out there?
Well, we did put in 13 of those. However, we had a couple that failed. I mean, we're like everybody else, they were put in areas that we didn't have artificial watering, so it wasn't like your backyard. But those way stations that did succeed have had a lot of flowers in them and are nice attribute to the landscape.
How big is one of these rest stops, you know, just on average?
They can vary. Everywhere from a half acre to larger. I think the largest that we put in was 2 acres in size.
Hmm. Sarah, I'm wondering, as you rode along, were you literally keeping up with the monarchs? Can you go as fast as they fly?
I can keep up with them for a few minutes, usually. Then they don't have to follow the road, so they go off, and I'm like, wait, and they ditch me. The great thing about the monarch butterfly and planning a bicycle route with them is they really spread out in the summer range and the spring and fall. So I could basically pick any road in Missouri and bike through it and likely see a monarch if I'm there at the right time of year. And so I kind of get to choose a great route, and we intersect and we see each other. 2 days ago, I saw probably about 80 on the Katy Trail, and it was really incredible.
Are they plentiful enough that you could be surrounded by them at times?
On the migration, not as much. There are places, but my bike trip hasn't carried me there, or it hasn't been perfect timing. But like I said, a few days ago, I saw probably about 80, and they were swirling around in front of me and above me. And I actually thought it was one following me for a while, but it turns out I stopped and looked and was like, oh my gosh, that's a lot.
They don't recognize you, right? And so that's Sarah Dykeman. Let's go hang with her for a while. She's our friend.
Yeah, I don't think so. But I do tell all of them that I'll see them in Mexico, and I'm hoping for some like amazing surprise party.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
How many miles a day were you doing?
I go about 60 miles a day.
Wow.
But because I'm going to schools and doing lots of presentations, sometimes I have to up that number in order to get there by a Friday, or sometimes I need to go a little slower and take my time to just match schedules.
So planning your schedule and sort of saying you can be at a certain school on a certain day, I bet you've gotten mad at yourself a few times because you've had to stretch it a little bit.
Yes, sometimes the wind doesn't cooperate or the weather doesn't cooperate. But I am pretty good at planning at this point, and it is by far the hardest part of this trip, is just guessing where I'm going to be places and making it happen.
Dusty, in Missouri, do the butterflies have a fairly narrow path that they follow, or are they spread out all across the state?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on monarchs, but I would say they somewhat spread out, except that you will notice them more on the western edge of the state, and also probably a little bit on the eastern edge. And I don't know if that's just because of people's sightings and reportings, or if they tend to follow the waterways a little bit.
Huh. Do we know enough about them to know how often they'll stop during their migration, Dusty?
Well, I do not, but I think they typically like to rest in the evening. And that's one of the points with the way stations, is to provide them areas where they can actually fuel up for the trip. And access nectar.
What do we know about what made for a good way station?
Well, right now what we're emphasizing, or trying to emphasize, is having an extended bloom period. We know the monarch will start their migration in the spring and continue on through the migratory pattern going back south in the fall. So we'd like to have three plants in bloom in the early spring, three plants in bloom in the summer, and then three plants in bloom in the fall at a minimum. And then we superimpose milkweed in that mix, because that's where the monarch actually complete their life cycle and raise up the next generation.
Hmm. Sarah, tell us a little more about why you wanted to do this.
I am on this trip because I want to be a voice for the monarch. I tell folks that monarchs can't vote. Monarchs can't go to a city council meeting. They can't demand better milkweed for their kids. So that is our job. And we can be a voice for the monarchs by planting gardens, by talking to our neighbors, by showing kids in our neighborhood the milkweed at our yards. And my trip, I'm just trying to be a really loud voice, screaming at the top of my lungs while I ride my bike, going and doing lots of presentations, hopefully getting the attention of some media so that more people can read about it. I always tell folks, no one's going to dig up their yard because they heard me talk, but they might start adding more plants because they heard me, mm-hmm. and then they hear you, and then they just keep hearing more and more people. So I just want to be another voice adding to the conversation.
I bet kids get a big kick out of seeing you.
They do. I love the kid presentations. They're a lot of fun, and I have some jokes that second graders don't get, but the third graders appreciate.
you want to try one out on us? And maybe with the risk being that I won't get it?
Yeah. The best joke I think I have that second graders, I just get a complete blank stare, is that I have my buckets on my bike that carry my stuff, and I say, this is my refrigerator. It only keeps food cold when it's cold out. Thank you.
The third graders, though.
Third graders, they're
going to get that, right?
The half of them get it. By fifth grade, it's like sympathy laughs. And then my public presentations with adults, they give me a little bit more.
Well, what do you find so compelling about this story and this plight of the monarchs?
For me, they're just up against so much. It just seems like against all the odds that this keeps going. They have to survive crossing roads and cities. They have to navigate thousands of miles. They have to deal with weather in three different countries. They have to only find milkweed. They have to find nectar plants. Like, there's just so many tiny little variables that add up to like a lot of challenges for them. But
the deck is stacked against
them. Exactly, right. And they're doing it, and they're surviving, and there's millions of them, and they connect all of us. They connect Canada to Mexico. They connect us to New York City. I saw a monarch in New York City. I couldn't believe it.
Really?
So the monarch is just like a symbol of sharing the planet, of North America, of conservation, of science.
Sarah Dykeman is my guest. She's a Johnson County native who's following the path of the monarchs. We're also joined by Dusty Walker, Director of Natural Resources Management at the University of Missouri. If by chance you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dusty, we hear the monarch is associated with one plant, the milkweed. Tell us why.
Well, the milkweed is the only plant that monarch completes its life cycle. And so by that, what we mean is that they lay their egg on the plant. The monarch larvae, the caterpillar, hatches out and feeds on that plant. And the milkweed has some poison in it that as the caterpillar, that larvae, feeds on the plant, that poison becomes part of its system and carries on through the process to where the monarch butterfly emerges. That makes that monarch have a bitter taste or give animals and birds an upset stomach when they eat it. And so animals and birds tend to associate the black and orange as a negative, and so they don't feed on it as much. So the monarch and the milkweed have this symbiotic relationship that, or at least the monarch benefits from eating that poisonous plant and making that poison a part of their system.
I'm wondering, Dusty, how dramatically has the population of the monarchs declined in recent years? What do we know about that?
Well, I've looked at some of the reports, and really where they like to emphasize is the overwintering site down in Mexico. And at its peak, at least on the data I'm looking at, back in 1996 to 97, that overwintering period, the monarchs inhabited about 44 acres down there. Now that's been reduced down to about 7 acres that they find the monarchs on. So there's been a steady reduction, although it's not, you know, it's there's ups and downs in it. So there's a lot of other variables, including the weather, and that has an impact on their population.
Sir, have you seen that place that Dusty's talking about in Mexico and what it used to be and what it is today?
Yes, I went there last winter, and it was incredible. And I have nothing to compare it to, but people that I've spoken with can actually see a difference. They can see a noticeable decline. But even with declines, there is just so many monarchs. And the best part is when they're all flying, you can hear like millions of monarch wings beating.
Is that right?
It's really spectacular.
Do you have pictures of yourself sort of surrounded by them down there?
I have a few good photos, and I have probably about 5,000 really blurry ones. I'd be happy to show them all.
I'm guessing that you've gone through a lot of farming communities. Did you notice if people had gardens friendly to butterflies? Are you seeing more of that?
So it can get a little depressing biking through the suburbs, biking through cornfields, biking through ditches that have just recently been mowed. But at the same time, I kind of feel that when I find a person that has a garden, it's kind of like my medicine. It's like, okay, it's a reminder that there are people fighting. And it's a hard fight, but their kids are there. The next generation is there to continue this. And I'm...
Dusty, what would it take for our listeners to turn a patch of our yards into a monarch way station? And what are the most important plants to include?
Well, first of all, I don't think you have to have a large area. At a minimum, we'd say 100 square feet, which may sound big, except that it's really only 10 feet by 10 feet, a square area.
Right.
So it's pretty small. I would recommend then that you first and foremost get your milkweed established. And then you can incorporate some flowering plants that bloom, again, from the spring through the summer and the end of the fall. So there's great resources out there, including some from the Missouri Department of Conservation. One of those, which is titled Backyard Habitat Requirements for Monarch Butterflies, that'll help you pick out the flowers you want based on the color, based on how tall they're going to get, and the season that they bloom.
Do they need to be in a certain part of your yard?
Well, you'll just want to pick plants that match primarily the light that you're getting. So if you've got an area that's full sun, then there's certain plants that are probably better adapted to that full sun versus the partial shade.
Okay. Dee from Overland Park. Dee, you're on Up to Date. Are you there, Dee?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead, Dee.
Okay. My question is, how do I find milkweed in Overland Park?
Great question. Dusty?
I think that is a good question. There is a group out in Kansas that will sell you started, or that will provide started milkweed. That's monarchwatch.org. So monarchwatch.org. Or you can look at many wildflower companies that will have the milkweed seed for you, so that you can either order the seed or purchase some started plants.
Okay, that's great advice, Dee. I appreciate the phone call. You know, I'm wondering what biking in rural Mexico what was like as you rode along, Sarah.
I really enjoy Mexico. I love that you can basically knock on any door in Mexico, in rural Mexico, and you can kind of sniff around. You can say, oh, you cooking something? Can I buy a plate of that?
Really?
And it's not weird. They just invite you in, ask you what you want to drink. I never cooked any beans. I never bought a tin of beans, but I would eat beans almost every day that I just would take, or not take, but I would get from locals.
When you tell them what you're doing, do they believe you, or do they look at you like you've got five eyeballs?
I think that they believe me, and I talk about the monarch, and most of them have heard about the monarch.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists don't know a lot about where the monarchs go from Mexico to Texas, but they think they follow the mountain ranges. And it was interesting, when I was in Mexico, every single person I talked to said they only come through in the fall. Hmm. So there's still lots of pieces to the puzzle, but the Mexicans were incredibly welcoming and generous, and I got a lot of ice cream and tacos and burritos.
Is it a lonely journey?
I don't find it lonely. I'm stopping in so many different places that I'm meeting so many people. And then when I'm not with people, when I'm not in towns, I'm on the road by myself, but I like that. And I'm with millions of monarchs.
Yeah. We'll keep you company.
Yep.
I should point out that Sarah Dykeman will be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Center. That's right across the street from KCUR Studios at 4750 Troost Avenue. Again, tomorrow night at 7 at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Center. This isn't the first thing you've done that strikes some of us as out there a little bit. You've also been on the show talking about your 3,500-mile canoe trip. I'm wondering, what's your deal, Sarah?
I love exploring. I like looking at a map and being like, oh, I wonder what it looks like from this point to that point. And then when I've done it, I like looking at the map and being like, dang, I've biked from there to there. And there's so many little mini adventures to be had and big adventures to be had. And the world is full of really unique, amazing things that are worth checking out.
Dusty, when do you plan to do your own bike ride from Missouri down to Mexico?
Well, I may become inspired. It does sound very...
She's inspiring, that's for sure.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, you hear so much in the way of negative press about Mexico and how tourists should be cautious. So I really, you know, her comments are really refreshing.
Yes, they are. Absolutely. Let's go back to some calls and David from Waldo. David, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hello, David.
I'm Steve. You're David. Yeah.
I'm calling to my phone's connection's kind of bad, but I'm calling to ask, what are the causes of population of monarchs?
What's causing the decline in the population of the monarch, Sarah?
So there's a lot of factors. Probably the biggest one is habitat loss. All of the United States, or all of the range of the United States that the monarchs lived in, used to be habitat. They used to be able to find the milkweed and their nectar plants. And as we build roads and cities and suburbs and parking lots, that habitat disappears. Another way the habitat disappears is with herbicides. So ever since we've developed broad-spectrum herbicides, we can spray all the ditch rows that used to have milkweed in them, that used to provide habitat, and that's gone.
Are there ways that people can, you know, join you on this trip? I put quotes around the word join. How can they connect with you as you move along?
So they can read about my trip on my website. It's called beyondabook.org. And I've got blogs. I have photos. I have a GPS tracker, so every day you can see just how slow I go.
Not 60 miles a day, Sarah. That's not too bad.
But it doesn't look that big on a map.
Let me go back to some calls. And Bill from Miriam. Bill, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm curious about when you say get the milkweed established, is it a perennial, an annual? Does it reseed itself? Does it grow from the root? What else?
Right. Good questions. Dusty, help Bill out there.
It does produce seed, but it will come back from the root as well. So once established, your plants should come back annually.
Oh.
But then the seed that they produce could also be established.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right, Bill. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, Sarah, where are you going next?
I'm headed south to Lewisburg and then all the way to Arkansas, Texas, and back to Mexico.
Back to Mexico. And when do you wrap this up?
Probably around the end of November. The Monarchs are going to beat me there by a few weeks, but like I said, probably there'll be a surprise party.
Then what's next for you after that?
Ooh, good question.
You haven't decided yet, eh?
I haven't decided yet.
You have time to think about it on your bike.
I have lots of time to think, yeah.
All right. Well, Sarah Dykeman, again, you can see and hear her tomorrow evening at 7 at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Center, 4750 Troost, to see Sarah. And I also want to thank Dusty Walker, Director of Natural Resources Management at the University of Missouri. Thank you both for a great conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Sarah, travel safe, okay?
Will do.
Coming up, former Star reporter Malcolm Garcia will talk to us about the deportation of U.S. veterans. And yes, I said that right. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we spoke with rock icon and advocate Melissa Etheridge. We also learned about the legacy of Kansas City businesswoman and philanthropist Marjorie Powell Allen. You can find those conversations at kcur.org. Tomorrow, the smart money experts share tips on how to handle your finances in the aftermath of a natural disaster. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, here's a sentence that doesn't quite make sense, but it's true. This country sometimes deports its military veterans. That's right. Maybe like you, I had assumed that you couldn't serve your country unless you were a full-fledged citizen. And if a veteran commits a certain type of crime back on American soil, he or she can be shown the door. Those crimes can include possession of marijuana or even check fraud. Former Kansas City Star reporter Malcolm Garcia struggles with this issue in his latest book, Without a Country, The Untold Story of America's Deported Veterans. Malcolm also is the author of What Wars Leave Behind, The Faceless and the Forgotten, which chronicled his travels to war zones across the globe. He joins us this morning from the studio in Orlando. Malcolm, it's nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Good to hear you.
So we were both, they have to be a full-fledged citizen to serve in the military. Do I have that right?
That's right. You don't have to be. And in some cases, you don't even have to be here legally. A number of the veterans that I spoke to who were deported enlisted, explained they weren't citizens, and they told me that not to worry about it, we'll take care of that while you're in the service.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
And the problem comes up in 1996. A law was passed called the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it essentially boils down to that if an immigrant convicted of crimes that meet the definition of aggravated felony and serve at least a year in prison can be deported. So some of these veterans have come back, they've committed crimes, they've served a jail sentence, they were convicted, served a jail sentence, and then they're deported.
This is amazing to me. You wrote this for Newsweek, Malcolm. When the government is done with them, they're subjected to the same as new arrivals sneaking across the border. So status as a military veteran is worth nothing then when it comes to the way this nation regards them. What do you make of that?
Well, to emphasize your point, the act is written in such a way that an immigration judge cannot consider their military service. The judge can only consider if their crime was a violation of the 1996 law. So you're absolutely right. Their military service means so little that they can't even bring it up in their defense.
You know, I'm wondering what members of the service who have been born abroad think about this and this idea that they aren't promised citizenship in exchange for their service. Do a lot of them, you know, sign up for the military assuming they'll become full-fledged citizens in the course of that service?
The men I talk to all assume that. A lot of them, you know, joined the military because they were living in poor neighborhoods, inner city, and they saw it as a way out. But they all did assume that their enlistment, once they were accepted, automatically inferred citizenship.
You know, one of the key terms here, talking about that 1996 law that you've told us about, is aggravated felony. That's what these veterans have to have committed to trigger a deportation. But that term is a little bit misleading. What constitutes an aggravated felony?
Well, it's much of what any of us would think: murder, drug, okay, firearms possession. But the definition is also expanded to include much, you know, crimes that we would consider, you know, not aggravated felonies at all, such as theft, failure to report a change of address, possession of marijuana, which is legal now in some states. All that can lead to deportation and the charge of aggravated felony.
What's your sense as to why this law was passed to begin with, Malcolm?
You know, it's hard to remember back to 96, particularly given all the immigration issues we're facing now. But even in the mid-90s, immigration was a hot-button issue. And so this was a law passed to reassure people that, you know, that we were going to take a tough stance on immigrants. They, you know, we only have, you know, good people here, and the bad ones we'd throw out. So it was seen as sort of a backstop to get some immigration policy through without really seeing the effect that this law could have.
Author and former Kansas City Star reporter Malcolm Garcia is my guest. His latest book, Without a Country, The Untold Story of America's Deported Veterans. Okay, so we deport our vets. How many have we deported over the years, Malcolm?
The VA doesn't keep account of that. The estimates that I've received from a group in Tijuana that runs a support house for deported veterans estimates about 3,000 people have been deported, and they're deported all over. They had records of people being deported anywhere from Mexico, which doesn't sound surprising, to Somalia. There's a man now facing deportation to Iraq. So we're not only just deporting people, we're deporting people in some countries that is really if it's not a death sentence, they're dancing real close to it.
Well, that's a lot of people, 3,000. It's more than I thought.
Right. No, it's quite a few.
How did you find these people, the veterans who have been deported?
I was looking at doing a story on homeless veterans, and I spoke to a social worker who said that I should really be looking into this issue of deported veterans. And like you, I had never even, you know, considered that was even an issue. And so through her, I got in touch with a lawyer who was representing a veteran in Pennsylvania, and then he told me about the group in Tijuana. So that got the ball rolling.
You know, this is a tough topic because these vets have committed crimes, and that sort of takes a little wind out of the idea here. But your point is that these folks wind up being punished twice. Talk to us about that.
Well, that's a good point. And the veterans themselves who are deported don't pretend that, you know, they're saintly. Some of these guys committed very serious offenses that would not arouse anyone's sympathy. However, it's important to realize that, you know, they were charged with a crime, convicted, and did a jail sentence. It's not as if they just got away with something. And two, the bigger question is, how are they not one of us? They wore our uniform. They took an oath to the U.S. Constitution to uphold our flag. Had they been killed in combat, they would be considered an American soldier killed in combat. The news media wouldn't say a Mexican national died in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they committed a treasonous act, they wouldn't be sent to Mexico for trial. They would have been tried as a soldier who had committed a treasonous act. And to compound, so that's one question. So given that they're doing everything that a citizen does, the only thing that they're missing is a paper. How are they not, you know, one of us? It's not just, are they citizens? They're one of us. How are they not Americans? The other issue is, if you're deported, but you left the military with a clean military record, when you die in the country you're deported to, you're still eligible for a full military funeral in the United States.
So think about that for a moment. And that's the way you ended your Newsweek piece, and you talk about it in the book. So you're kicked out of the country, but after you die, then you're welcomed back.
If you have an honorable discharge, you are eligible for a full military funeral, and your body can be shipped back and taken to, you know, Arlington or wherever you want to be, whatever military cemetery you want to be in, and you have a full military funeral, 21-gun salute, American flag, the whole routine.
What does the military say about all this? Do they have a defense? Do they have an explanation for why things are happening the way they are?
Not to the people that I spoke to. The Department of Homeland Security says, you know, gives the sort of this the blanket statement that they take very seriously someone's military service, and if they're charged with a crime, that service should be considered and taken in light of everything else. But in reality, given the nature of the law, it can't be considered.
Again, Malcolm Garcia is my guest. His new book, Without a Country, The Untold Story of America's Deported Veterans. I wanted to ask you about two people that you talk about a lot in the book. Let's start with Jose Chavez Alvarez. He's from Pennsylvania. Who is he?
He grew up in California. He's a Mexican national, came here as a child. His mother was murdered when he was still a child. He enlisted in the Army in the early 90s, had an honorable discharge, re-enlisted, had an honorable discharge. Third enlistment, he went to South Korea as his, part of his third deployment. And then he was charged and convicted of sexual assault of a fellow Army soldier, mm-hmm. a woman. He did 18 months in prison. He was released, obviously, out of the Army. He was court-martialed out of the Army. And then 10 years later, ICE, and he didn't do, had no other run-in with the law after that. And then 10 years later, ICE came knocking at his door and said, we're aware of this felony conviction. You have to go.
Why do you think these cases are a priority for ICE?
You know, priority for ICE, but I, you know, there's been a lot of talk about immigrants committing crimes. The data doesn't support that contention, but that's out there. And it's ICE's job to round up people who are not citizens, and they prioritize people with a criminal record. Now, there are certainly allegations that they're just rounding up anybody. But at the time with Chavez, was getting undocumented people with a criminal record. That was their focus, to get them out of the country.
Because you point out that ICE, and again, ICE is the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, it does have discretion over whom it refers for removal, unlike the judges who don't have that same discretion, but ICE does.
Right, and I spoke, and it's hard to say why a particular ICE agent will do what they do. I spoke to one immigrant attorney who said that ICE is a numbers game, and they want to show that they're getting, you know, they're meeting expectations. They're getting X number of people removed from the country, whether, you know, that's her interpretation. But the bottom line is that in the end, they're focusing on people irregardless of what they've done on behalf of the country, and that's where veterans fall in.
How about another man you write about here? You write about him a lot, Hector Boreas Varela, who runs the Deported Veterans Support House down in Tijuana, Mexico. You visited there. Tell us about Hector, because he's a deported veteran as well.
Right. And Hector has really been pushing this issue. If it hadn't been for Hector, we probably wouldn't be talking about it right now. He's been beating the drum on this for years. He grew up in Compton near Los Angeles, served in the Army from 1995 to 2001, has an honorable discharge. In 2004, he was convicted of discharging a firearm into a car while he's in Compton. He denies that that happened. He served a 3-year prison sentence and then was deported. He snuck back in, was caught, and was deported again in 2009. Since he's been in Tijuana, he started really a social service agency that everybody refers to as the Bunker, mm-hmm. but its official name is what you just said, Deported Veterans Support House. And it offers social services, shelter, food. He works with the VA, trying to get guys the pensions that they have coming for them, depending on, you know, their discharge papers, if it was honorable, etc. So he's been just going above and beyond the call of duty, helping these guys who get deported. He reaches out to people in other countries. And on top of that, he helps homeless people in Tijuana. So if anybody has turned their life around, it's Hector Barajas, and he's still fighting to be let in.
Describe the Bunker to us, because it's located in a former auto repair shop.
Yeah, you wouldn't know that when you're in it. It's really like a storefront. So you walk in, and it would look like any office you walk into, and you stop at the front desk, and you would say, I have an appointment with so-and-so. But he's decorated it as a living room, and there's a board up with various activities. On the second floor is the shelter, army cots for guys who need a place to stay while Hector's working with them, trying to help them get work, trying to help them find an apartment, trying to help them with their papers and the benefits they're due.
You know, you focused your career on the poor, the downtrodden, in your reporting in Kansas City, and now in your writing career, your author career. I'm wondering why, Malcolm. What's been the draw for you?
Well, social services, mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. Working with homeless people, and in San Francisco, and I saw at the time how, other than Christmas, nobody really seemed to care about the people that I was working with. And on top of that, I've come from, you know, very good circumstances. So a combination of the two gave me a sense of obligation, I suppose, to and give back to people that haven't had the opportunities that I've had.
What difference do you hope this book makes? What do you hope comes out of all this?
Well, I hope, one, that people realize that veterans are being deported. Mm-hmm. I hope, two, it raises questions among people about what it means to be an American citizen. I think these men show that it's much more than just a piece of paper or a birth certificate. And if people who have fought and were willing to put their lives on the line, and some of these guys have post-traumatic stress disorder from the first and second Gulf War, if that's not enough to consider someone a citizen, then I think we really have to ask ourselves, exactly what do we mean by a citizen, and when is it that someone is not one of us? Because if anybody's one of us, these guys are. We don't have to like them, but that doesn't mean we can't say they're one of us.
Malcolm Garcia's book, Without a Country, The Untold Story of America's Deported Veterans. Malcolm, it's always great to have you here, and good luck with the book, okay?
Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
You bet. This was an interesting weekend for NFL fans, some of whom maybe just wanted to focus on the games, but that was nearly impossible. Here to explain why is sports reporter Greg Eklund. Greg, welcome back.
Welcome back, and welcome to you, Steve.
Let's start with how the Chiefs did, Greg. They were up against the Los Angeles Chargers on Sunday. Pretty good outcome.
It was a good outcome for the Chiefs. They're only one of two teams in the NFL now with 3-0 records, the other being the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah.
And the only thing that you could surmise from the first three games the Chiefs have played, I shouldn't say the only thing, but one characteristic of this team is its ability to put away a game in the second half. They seem to do very well with halftime adjustments. And as we saw yesterday, the game was scoreless until Kareem Hunt, the rookie running back, broke free and scored another big run with a touchdown and put the game away at that point.
Fans probably saw before the game that several Chiefs players didn't stand for the national anthem. I think a lot of people probably saw that coming. What was most notable about that?
Well, the most notable thing is, if anything, there's solidarity in the league toward the comments that were expressed by the President of the United States just a couple of days earlier in Huntsville, Alabama. Marcus Peters was the only one prior to yesterday's national anthem, and his stance has gone back to last year with him, a Bay Area guy. He grew up in Oakland and across the Bay. Last year, and Colin Kaepernick didn't stand because of social injustices and his stand against police brutality against African Americans.
And you look at what Colin Kaepernick has started. It's amazing.
It's also amazing because Colin Kaepernick is still without a job in the NFL. No NFL team to this date has shown any interest in signing him, and it could be argued that Colin Kaepernick's quarterback talents are better than more than a handful of backup quarterbacks in the National Football League.
Do you buy the notion that he was blackballed?
Well, it's hard to discount that, Steve, because as I had just said, the talent is there, and there just seems to be some mysterious, and I use air quotes on that, reason why he is not signed to this point.
You know, by kneeling, sitting, or locking arms, are players agreeing with Kaepernick's original protest about the social injustices and police brutality toward African Americans, or are they supporting his right to freedom of expression?
Well, we really don't know. I mean, Marcus Peters took his stand last year, and he hasn't spoken this year about why he continues to take that stand. As we know from yesterday, because of the president fanning the flames in this situation, that there was more solidarity to that. But for the reasons they were standing or chose to, in Justin Houston's case, pray, or those owners who took the sideline to lock arms with their players, we know that they're speaking most likely in solidarity against the president's comments, but what we don't really know is what they're protesting against.
Chiefs owner Clark Hunt came out with a statement. It was criticized as being lukewarm, milquetoast, but what did he have to say here?
Well, to pull and extract a quote from that statement, Clark said, "Honoring the American flag and supporting all those whose sacrifices protect the many freedoms we have in this country, including the right to have differences of opinion," which really doesn't take a stand one way or the other. There's no comment directly toward the president, and there's not really a strong feeling toward the players who have chosen, and there were a number of them yesterday, in addition to Marcus Peters, to not stand or to do, in Houston's case, kneel while the national anthem was played.
What about the other NFL owners here, Greg? Is there a united front here, or is it like the players with different owners taking different approaches to all this?
Well, there are different owners taking different approaches. Some of them spoke with their actions yesterday. Many owners locking arms with their players on the sidelines. And another owner, most notably Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, speaking out saying that he was deeply disappointed by the president's remarks. And it's not just among the NFL owners. The NBA owner, Vivek Ranadive, excuse me if I'm mispronouncing that, but to the best of my ability, he is the Sacramento Kings owner whose roots are in Asia. He also came out with a statement saying that the president's comments are deeply disappointing.
And I should point out Robert Kraft is an ally or a buddy of President Trump's, from what I read. Yeah.
Right.
So what do we make of the statement by Clark Hunt then?
Well, I'm going to cite the columnist in the Kansas City Star, Sam Mellinger, who took a stand by saying, in his words, the leader of Kansas City's second most iconic institution behind barbecue missed a chance to lead. And that refers back to what you had referred to when you thought that it was a kind of a milquetoast statement mm-hmm. put out by the Kansas City Chiefs.
There are signs now this protest could be spreading to other sports, including, of all these different sports, NASCAR.
Yeah, and that would be interesting because we have a NASCAR race coming up here in Kansas City next month, and it's going to be interesting to see how this spreads, not just among NASCAR. We're seeing it in Major League Baseball. The NBA teams now are going through their media days. I'm sure there is going to be a lot of questions and answers taking place over the next week or so among NBA players, and the NBA has taken on these kind of issues head on. In speaking about the NFL, Roger Goodell did come out with a statement yesterday, very limited, but he did call the comments by the president, in his words, divisive.
That's sports reporter Greg Eklund. Greg, thanks for the recap. We sure appreciate it.
You're welcome, Steve.
You can download our podcast and listen to previous shows. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the smart money experts are back to share advice on managing your money in the aftermath of a natural disaster. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.